Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon. We have an open phone line for you. You can call with any question you may wish to ask about the Bible or the Christian faith, and we'll talk about that. You can call if you have a different viewpoint from the host and want a balanced comment. I'd love to hear from you if you want to do that as well. The number to call is 844-484-5737. And I have to say right now, it looks like maybe all the lines are full. So if you call that number right now, you might get a busy signal. But take this number down. Call in a few minutes. You may find a line open. That often is the norm. The number again is 844-484-5737. Now, a couple of announcements. Tomorrow is Thursday, and every Thursday morning in Southern California, we have an early morning Bible study at 6:30 in Temecula, going through the life of Christ, harmonizing the four Gospels, a very much in-depth study of the life and teaching of Jesus. Welcome you all to attend if you happen to be anywhere nearby. Even not very nearby, we have people who drive long ways to get there most Thursday mornings. And that's held at the Panera Bread in Temecula. Panera Bread, right across the street from Costco in Temecula. If you'd like to join us, 6:30 Thursday mornings, that's tomorrow. Be glad to see you there. Now, for those of you who are in the Sacramento area, I'm going to be speaking in quite a few times, actually. Looks like four times at least in 3 days in Sacramento, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. If you're in the area, you may be interested in knowing that there's a debate on Friday night between myself and Doug Batchelor, who's also on some of these same stations. Doug is a Seventh-day Adventist, and I'm not, and we're going to be discussing the Sabbath, the difference in the view held by the Seventh-day Adventists on the Sabbath and the view that Christians have held throughout most of history, and which I myself hold. So there'll be it'll be a dialogue. It's not going to be an argument. But we are going to present arguments, and so you're welcome to join us for that. That's in Rockland, up in the Sacramento area. That's Friday night, and then Saturday morning and Saturday afternoon and Sunday afternoon. I have other meetings. Most of those are in homes, although the Saturday afternoon is in an auditorium. And I'm hoping on Saturday afternoon to follow up on the debate, because during the debate, each of us really has only 20 minutes to present a case, and then to, you know, 10-minute rebuttals, and then there's Q&A. Obviously, only a small fraction of what needs to be covered will be covered in the debate. And for those interested in the Sabbath question, we'll have follow-up discussion and Q&A on it on Saturday afternoon. Now, if you're interested in any of those meetings, the debate is at our website on the announcements page at thenarrowpath.com under announcements, the debate Friday night. The other meetings are not, and we can't get them up there right now because the website's on the fritz. Some things are working on the website. Some things are not at the moment. That's been true for a couple of weeks. And so if you would like to have the locations of those meetings, first of all, I post them on my Facebook page. There's my personal Facebook page under Steve Gregg. Also, there's the Narrow Path Facebook page. Those locations are posted there. If you have any trouble finding them, you can email me, steve@thenarrowpath.com. Very simple. steve@thenarrowpath.com. And just say, I'd like to know the dates and the locations of your weekend meetings in Sacramento. And we'll be glad to let you know. I'll email them to you. Okay, that's coming up this weekend. One other thing. All next week, I'll be in Seattle area. And I've got things going on morning and night, just about every day I'm up there. I'm going to be up there a whole week. I'll be speaking for Youth with a Mission on the weekday mornings. I'll be speaking evenings in different locations. Lots of them are Q&As. But we'll be posting that as soon as we can get the website working right. But that's coming up next week. I'll be in the Seattle area for a week starting Monday. And so I'm in Sacramento this weekend and in Seattle the following week. So just so you'll know that stuff. And by the way, if you're having trouble downloading things from our website because of the issues we're having, I want you to know there's an alternative website you can go to that has all of our radio programs and all my lectures there. And if you can't get them from my website, you can get them from this one, theos.org/media. Now, theos is spelled T-H-E-O-S. It's the Greek word for God, theos. www.radiolegends.org/media. So if you've been having frustration trying to get the radio shows or lectures from our website, some of them come up, some of them don't. We're going to get that fixed eventually, but in the meantime, you can go to theos.org/media and get all that information. Whew, that's a lot of announcements. I don't usually give that many, but there's just a lot going on right now. Let's talk to Craig from Roseville, California. Craig, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thank you. Yeah. A couple questions for you. So Revelation's written sometime between 68 AD and 96 AD. And then
probably,
70 AD,
yeah.
Jerusalem is destroyed. How did, and if John's on the island of Patmos, how does his letters get to the seven churches and then to Jerusalem so that way those people know about the tribulation coming?
Well, first of all, I don't know that the letter was intended to go to Jerusalem, even if it's about Jerusalem. The letter is addressed to the seven churches in Asia Minor, which was what we'd call Turkey today. So it's not really sent to Israel. If it is about the fall of Jerusalem, it is not something that's sent to Jerusalem, to the Jerusalem church about it. I think that might be because the Christians from Jerusalem had already fled anyway. We do read in Eusebius, the church historian, that before the war began, an oracle was given from God in the Jerusalem church telling them all to flee from the city, and they did. So the Christians were forewarned, not only by that oracle, but of course by the Olivet Discourse, which Jesus had given, and he had told them that they should be prepared to flee to the mountains because Jerusalem would be destroyed. So there was adequate warning to the church in Jerusalem apart from the book of Revelation, but the book of Revelation was actually written to churches that were in another vicinity. Now, how the letter got from Patmos to its recipients is not clear. It's entirely possible, though, that the letter was written after John, at least in its final form, and sent after John was back in Ephesus, because he begins in Revelation 1 saying, I was in the island of Patmos for the word of God, and I saw these things. So he speaks as if perhaps he wasn't still there, but he had been there. He had been on the island of Patmos when he had these visions. And no doubt he took down notes, because even while he's seeing the visions, for example, in chapter 10, he says, I was going to write this down, but a voice told me, don't write it down. You know, what the seven trumpets said, or the seven thunders said, excuse me. So apparently John was writing stuff down when he was seeing the visions, but the letter might not have been crafted and put together and sent until he was no longer at Patmos, because he opens by saying, I was at Patmos when I saw these visions. So it's possible that he was back in Ephesus, and the letter would have been carried to the other churches in the same region. We know John went back to Ephesus after Patmos. That's what the church fathers tell us, and he died in Ephesus. Now, Ephesus was one of the seven churches in Asia, and the others were close enough that the letter could be carried to them.
Okay. And then in Revelation 7, when it talks about the 144, it lists out all the tribes other than the tribe of Dan. Now, the 10 tribes from the north were taken by the Assyrians, and the two tribes, I think it was Judah and Benjamin, were taken by the Babylonians a number of years later. Now, those two tribes returned, but did those other 10, any of the other 10 return?
No, they did not.
I guess from the Assyrian when they were taken? Or did they just assimilate with the Assyrians?
No, they did not. No, the northern tribes were taken, and they were absorbed into the Syrian Empire. The Assyrian Empire and later Babylonian Empire, and so they never were they never returned. Now, on the other hand, before Jerusalem fell, actually before Samaria fell in 722 BC, quite a few of the people from the 10 tribes had escaped to Jerusalem or to Judah, because they didn't like the apostasy and the idolatry that King Jeroboam in the north had established. And they wanted to be true to the God of their fathers. So they actually left their own tribal territories in the north and removed themselves to live in Judah. We read about that in the book of 1 Kings and 2 Kings. So that there were people from all of the tribes who had escaped from the north and had become part of the nation of Judah. Now, they would be called Jews because of their belonging to the nation of Judah, but they were of different tribes because they had come from the northern tribes. So the nation of Judah, after Samaria fell in the north, had a population that was made up of people from all 12 tribes, although certainly the vast majority from the tribe of Judah and from Benjamin, but there were some from the other tribes too. So when Judah was taken into captivity in Babylon, this meant that people of all 12 tribes who had been part of the kingdom of Judah were taken into Babylon. And when people returned from Babylon, it would have been no doubt representatives of them, of the different tribes. So there were, although the nation of Judah alone was restored, the nation of Judah had come to be more heterogeneous in terms of its the tribal demographics. So there were 12, the 12 tribes still had some representation for centuries afterwards. You know, James writes his epistle to the 12 tribes, which are scattered abroad in James 1:1. And Jesus told the apostles, you 12 will sit on 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. So even in New Testament times, it was possible to speak about the 12 tribes, but the northern tribes no longer existed as tribes in their tribal territories. It was rather individuals from those tribes survived as part of the nation of Judah.
Okay, then you'd have the 144,000, the 12,000.
Right, if,
the 12 tribes.
Yeah, now, and of course, because I take so much in Revelation to be symbolic, I'm not sure that we have to have all 12 tribes, literally 12,000 from each tribe to make up that body, but that's another story.
Okay. And then if I wanted to read one of Josephus' books regarding what the Romans did to Jerusalem, is there one in modern English that you could recommend?
Yeah, I believe there is. I don't have the modern English one. I have I have Josephus' own words, but I know that there are people who have paraphrased at least maybe not the whole of Josephus' work, which is very voluminous, but the passages in Josephus that are interesting to Christians particularly, I know have been edited and updated the language and so forth, but I don't have that. I've seen it. I don't have that book,
okay.
So I don't know what the name of it would be. You'd have to do your own research on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, Craig. Thank you for your call. Good talking to you. All right. Casey from Seattle, Washington, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling. Oh, I hit the button, but it didn't go on. Let me see here. Okay, my mistake. Hi, Casey.
Oh, hey, Steve. I got a question for you about divorce and remarriage. I want to first tell you what I think and have you tell me if I'm wrong on something. In Deuteronomy 24, there was an original one case where God allowed divorce, and that was if a man finds uncleanness in his new wife.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Matthew 5, Jesus kind of reiterates that and says, but I say to you, everyone who divorces his wife, except for the reason of unchastity or fornication, some verses say, makes her commit adultery. So my question is, there's a lot of people that say, you know, having an affair or abandonment and stuff like that is a valid case for divorce. But Jesus in Matthew 5 says there's only one exception. So what's your view on that? And how do I think through this?
Well, having an affair is committing adultery, is committing fornication against one's spouse. Are you thinking in terms of a man committing adultery as the question? Or
I'm just thinking if a man divorces his wife for any reason other than he finds out she's not a virgin, which is what I take Deuteronomy 24 to say.
Oh, I see.
Maybe that's the wrong premise of mine, but that's what I think it says.
You know, in the law, if a woman got married to a man claiming to be a virgin, and it turned out that she wasn't, that was actually an offense punishable by death under the law. So divorce would be for something else. Deuteronomy says if a man finds some uncleanness in her, but that the word uncleanness is very vague. It doesn't necessarily mean that she wasn't a virgin at the time she was married, but finding some uncleanness simply means there's something, you know, not right about her, but it doesn't signify what. And I think Jesus' words are to clarify that. I think he's saying, well, the uncleanness in question is, of course, adultery. Or he says fornication, but the word fornication, porneia in the Greek, refers to any kind of sexual sin, which for a married person, that'd normally be adultery. It might be homosexuality or bestiality or incest or other kinds of sexual sin, because all of those are fornication. And Jesus said fornication would be the only thing. Now, I will just clarify one thing. Jesus was speaking to people who are married within the same faith. That is, he's speaking to Jews who are married to Jews. Paul wrote to couples that were not in the same faith, because Paul would preach in Gentile lands where people are pagans, and one party would sometimes get married, I mean, get saved, but their marriage partner would not. So now Paul was addressing something Jesus never encountered. All the marriages Jesus encountered in Israel were Jews married to Jews. But Paul now had to address the situation of Christians married to non-Christians, because among the pagans he preached to, both parties of a couple would not necessarily get saved, but one of them might. And then they would wonder, well, should we get divorced from our unsaved partner? And Paul's answer was, no, you should not. You should stay married. But he says, if you have an unsaved partner and they don't want to stay with you, if they depart, then you're not in bondage to that marriage. So, and Paul specifically said, this is in 1 Corinthians 7, verse 12 through 15, he specifically said, this is something Jesus did not address. Because in verses 10 and 11, just before that, he says, I'm speaking to you who are married, but not I, but the Lord. Don't let the husband divorce his wife. Don't let the wife leave her husband. He said, I'm just repeating what the Lord said about that. But then he said, now to the rest, I, not the Lord, speak. Now, what he means by that is the Lord never spoke about this when Jesus was on earth. He never spoke about mixed marriages, religiously mixed marriages. And so Paul says, I'm going to have to speak about a subject Jesus did not address, because Jesus never encountered it. So we would have to say that what Jesus said in Matthew 5:32 and in Matthew 19:9 would be things he was addressing to people married within the same faith as each other, with their spouse. But Paul says there's an additional teaching that needs to be applied to a different situation, which was a new situation in Paul's day. And that was people who are married not within the faith. They've got a mixed marriage, religiously mixed. Keep the marriage together, he said. The Christian should never leave. But if the unbeliever leaves, then the marriage can be considered, the believer is free. And I believe that would even mean free to remarry.
Okay. So the final part of Matthew 5:32 says, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Does that mean that if a man marries a woman who's divorced, even on the grounds that that's good, that's adultery?
Well, some people would take it that way, because the statement is exceedingly brief and doesn't in itself allow itself of any exceptions. But we have to realize that when we're reading the Sermon on the Mount, especially that chapter, Matthew 5, almost everything Jesus said is in the form of a hyperbole. He talks about, and in chapter 6 too, he talks about, if someone sues you, take your garment, give them your cloak also. Give to everyone who asks you. Don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. When you pray, go into your room and shut the door and don't let anyone know you're praying. These kinds of things are what we call hyperbole. And they're making a point emphatically, but it doesn't mean that they would be without exception. Certainly they're. When Jesus says you shouldn't pray in public, he violated that himself, and so did the apostles, because there were public prayers recorded of Jesus and the apostles in the Bible. So it's a hyperbole, and a hyperbole would be something where it's not necessarily without exception, but it is something that expresses the principle as strongly as can be expressed. And I think that in that brief statement about divorce, what he is implying is this, that if a man divorces his wife and marries another and she marries another, then they're all committing adultery, unless it was for the cause of fornication. See, except for the cause of fornication, I think, is the exception is the exception to the whole statement, not just the first part of it. That's how I would understand it.
Okay, and then obviously we'd add in abandonment for the non-believer and believer.
Right, right.
Okay, cool. That helps a lot. Thank you, Steve.
Okay, I appreciate your call. Thanks for joining us. Chris from Canada is our next caller. Chris, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve.
Hey.
How's it going?
Good.
Good. It's good to talk to you today. I have a question today. In Matthew 18, beginning at verse 15, Jesus said that if your brother sins, go show him your fault in private. If he listens, you've won him over. Right? If he doesn't listen, go with someone else. And by the most of two or three, maybe you'll win him over. If not, take it to the church. And if you refuse to listen, let him be a Gentile or a tax collector. I'm just wondering, who would you take it to if you didn't have an institutional or a home church? And obviously this is a passage that some Roman Catholics used to prove their point,
sure,
because it said, if you, whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. So I'm just wondering, could this be a passage that could potentially affirm the Catholic view that the church has the final authority on matters?
Well, the church is the body of Christ, and it's not made up of a building or an organization or a 501c3 corporation or anything like that. That's what we call churches today, but that's an organizational situation that arose long after the time of Christ and in many ways compromised the truth of the church. The church is, there's one body. There's only one body. All Christians belong to it. In every town, all Christians there are the local church there, whether they go to the same building or not, or are part of the same organization. These separate organizations didn't exist in biblical times. So in Jesus' day and in the apostles' day, if you were living in Philippi, then you were in the church of Philippi. If you were in Ephesus, you were in the church of Ephesus. You were not in the First Baptist Church of Ephesus, as opposed to the First Assembly of God of Methodists of Ephesus or whatever. So, what I'm saying is that there was no question as to who the church was. The church was all the Christians there. Well, now there's some question, because now there's a bunch of organizations that call themselves churches. They don't require conversion to be a part of them. They don't require baptism in some cases to be a part of them. And sometimes even not only are the members, but sometimes some of the leaders don't give any evidence of being really saved people. This is not the real church. There are real people from the real church who are in these groups, but the organizations are themselves not the church. Neither is the Roman Catholic organization. There's no organization that's the church. The church is a spiritual body made up of people who have the spirit of Christ and who are following the headship of Christ. They're his body. And so if you're in a town where you, let's say you don't know what church to take someone before as an act of church discipline, then if they've been brought up and confronted on all the levels prior to the level of taking it before the church, and the church is so ununited in your town that there's no place to go to bring it before the whole church, then obviously you can't do exactly that. Jesus was describing a situation that should be done when the church is intact, when the church is, you know, as it should be. Now, when we live in an age 2,000 years later where the church is extremely evolved into something very different than what Jesus had in mind, I think the principle would have to be that we have to take the matter before the Christian people that we know. It doesn't have to be an organizational church, but I mean, we should all be fellowshipping somewhere. Many people who don't go to organizational churches anymore go to home churches or house churches or something. But I would say that, right. And so I would say it'd be something you bring before the people that you fellowship with and the person and ideally the people that that person is fellowshipping with. They may not belong to a church, but still you don't have to be part of an organizational church in order to exercise church discipline. You simply, you treat them the same way as if it was an organizational church that had disciplined them. You know, you let the people know, I've taken this matter to this person at two different levels. That person is refusing to repent. I'm letting the fellowship know that that's the case and that Jesus said, until they repent, they should be treated as a tax collector or a heathen. And that's the best you can do in a situation where the church isn't what it's supposed to be.
So do you think that even in a case if, like, for example, if you were a part of a maybe not an institutional church, but, you know, just a part of, like, any kind of fellowship group and, you know, your brother or whatever that's maybe living with you or whatever, and he's not a part of your fellowship group, perhaps he's not a part of any fellowship group, do you think that you would still have the right to try and take him to that group?
No,
if
he's not part of any fellowship group, then he's not in the church. So that putting him out of the church is a non-issue.
Right.
The purpose of that last stage of discipline is to put the person out of the church. If the person has already put themselves out of the church, then that's a non-issue. Now, if they're going to a different church, then I would, in a case like that, I would and have in the past gone to the leaders of the church that person's going to and lay out to them what Jesus said and what I've done and so forth and what I believe they should do. And then I would leave it with them. See, many leaders of churches don't want to obey Jesus. They don't want to have church discipline. I know they've told me. Many church pastors have said, we don't do that here, even though Jesus commands it. They just don't care about obeying Jesus as much as they care about whatever they care about. So I think after that's been done, you leave it with that, and you let the Christians that you do know, let them know that this person should be under discipline. And like Paul said, don't even eat with such a person until they repent. That's what you got to do. I mean, certainly the church is not what it once was, but the body of Christ still can act in harmony with itself about situations like that. We've got some stations going to leave our network at this moment because it's the half-hour break. We do have another half-hour. Most stations carry both hours, half hours. Some of you will not be with us, therefore, for the second half hour. I want you to know that The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. You can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate, if you wish, from the website, which is thenarrowpath.com. If you could stay with us for the next 30 seconds, we'll come back and we'll take another half hour of calls.
Small is the gate and narrow is the path that leads to life. Welcome to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you, but everything to give you. When today's radio show is over, we invite you to study, learn, and enjoy by visiting thenarrowpath.com, where you'll find free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all The Narrow Path radio shows. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Remember, thenarrowpath.com.
Welcome back to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we have another half hour to take your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith you'd like to call in about, or a different viewpoint from that of the host that you'd like to call in about. Unfortunately for you, if you're not waiting online already, is the lines are full. You can't get through to me right now because our lines are all full. But you can take this number down and call in as the numbers clear. And the lines do clear as I talk to these people and they move along. So you can have this number ready at hand. It's 844-484-5737. All right. And we're going to talk first today to Jada from Buckeye, Arizona. Hi, Jada. Good to hear from you.
Hi, Grandpa Steve.
How you doing?
Good.
Jada and her siblings, by the way, are not my actual grandchildren, but they're kind of like adoptive grandchildren in a way. Good to hear from you, Jada.
Mm-hmm. So my question today is in Matthew chapter 23, verse 9. It says, "Do not call anyone on earth your father, for one is your father, he who is in heaven." And I was wondering if he really meant don't call anyone father, like don't call your father.
No, he didn't mean that. In fact, Paul actually referred to the Corinthians as his children in the faith, and he was their father in the faith. And in 1 Corinthians 4, and also in Romans chapter 4, he referred to Abraham as our father. So Jesus is not saying that it's literally wrong to call somebody your father, assuming he is your father. So your dad is your father too. And so there's nothing wrong with calling somebody your father if he is your father. What Jesus is talking about is how the Pharisees, and this is what he's discussing in Matthew 23, is how the Pharisees liked to be called by honorary titles because it gave them some spiritual ranking or spiritual status in the community to be called rabbi or father or something like that. So when Jesus says, don't call anyone your rabbi, don't call anyone teacher, don't call anyone your father, he's not saying that it's wrong to refer to somebody as a teacher or a rabbi or a father, but only if it's true. You shouldn't use these things as titles of honor for a person's religious status. Jesus was completely against people seeking any kind of religious status or rank, and to use titles that are not descriptive of a person's real relationship with you, but they just are a title of honor given to them. Jesus was against that. So I think that if people wanted to be called reverend, I think it'd be similar. I think it'd be similar. Why call somebody reverend? That's just a title of honor. Or like Roman Catholics call the priests father. Now, the priests are not their father. Unless that priest led you to the Lord, he's not your father. If he led you to the Lord, he's your spiritual dad. But he's not that because he's a priest. He might be that because he really did lead you to the Lord. But most people who go to a Catholic church, they didn't become Catholics through the ministry of the particular priest who's leading that church. So calling him father would only be an honorary title. And that would be the kind of thing I think Jesus is telling us not to do.
Okay,
well, Jana?
Thank you.
Great talking to you. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome.
Bye now. All right. Humphrey from Oakland, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, this is about Genesis.
Uh-huh.
It said in the beginning there was darkness, right? And then God said, let there be light, and there was light. But then it said there's evening and day. So that was before we have sun and moon that was created in the first couple of days. So I'm assuming this light is God. God is light. And then, but all of a sudden you have evening, you have darkness again. So how do we reconcile that?
Well, let's just think for a moment about how we have light and darkness now. We have light and darkness now because the earth is turning. And there's every reason to believe the earth was turning as soon as God made it. That is, he made it turning. All right. Now, the reason it's light and darkness in sequence is because the light is coming from one direction. And therefore, the part of the earth that's facing that light source, which happens to be the sun for us, is light, while the other side of the earth is dark. But it spins so that both sides get their turn to be light or dark. Now, this would be true. This would be true even without the sun, if there was a light source coming from one direction. Now, we do read on the fourth day in Genesis that God made the sun and moon and stars to give light on the earth. So it's clear that he delegated that role of light giving to those heavenly bodies. But he didn't make them until the fourth day. Or some people think he did. Some people think he made them before that, but that they weren't visible from the earth. That's a possibility, too. But the point is that we don't need to have that explanation. It may be a true one, but with or without it, regardless where the light was coming from, as long as it's coming from one direction, it's sufficient to let there be a succession of light and darkness as the earth turns and part of the earth is exposed to that light and the other part is not. Now, I agree with you that the light, no doubt, was the light of God himself. I think it's similar to the description in Revelation 21 of the New Jerusalem, where it says the city had no need of the sun or the moon or the stars to light it, but the glory of God was the light of it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably the way it was on the earth before God made the sun, moon, and stars. Now, there's other explanations. I have some friends who give other explanations than that, but that's kind of how I've always tended to look at it. So that would answer the problem, I think.
But is God everywhere? I mean, it's not God. It's not just in one fixed position, right?
Sure. God is everywhere, but he's not manifest everywhere. You know, when he was when the Israelites were traveling in the wilderness, God was manifested in a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. And he came to rest in the tabernacle. That was where God was manifesting his presence. Now, God was everywhere else in the entire universe at the same time, but not manifested there. God is invisible. So where God manifests himself is a localized thing. In the Old Testament, sometimes God even appeared as a human form to wrestle with Jacob or do something like that, or to appear and talk to Abraham. So God could locally, in one place, manifest himself, even though he's not manifest, but truly present everywhere in the universe. So if he wanted to manifest his light from one direction, if that was his desire, if he wanted there to be a sequence of day and night, then that would be pretty much the way to do it. And so that could be what he did.
I see. A second question I have is regarding the sons of God in Genesis that came and mate with humans so that their offsprings are giants. Were giants. Who are the sons of God? Are they angels, or is it just a?
Lots of people think they're angels. I don't necessarily think they were. I think sons of God is a term that's used more often in the Bible to refer to people who are godly people. There may, in fact, be a reference to angels as sons of God in one passage in Job, or maybe in all the passages that Job uses sons of God, but that'd be altogether only three references to the sons of God, and all of them in the book of Job. Outside the book of Job, the term sons of God are used both in the Old Testament and the New Testament to refer to godly people. And so in Genesis 6, I think the sons of God probably are people. After all, they did start families with humans. I don't know how an angel could start a family with a human, since angels, Jesus said, they don't get married. And if they don't get married, they must not be made for marriage. And that would suggest they're not made to have sexual relations. And if God didn't make them to have sexual relations, why would they have any attraction to women? I mean, if a man is born without testicles, he's not going to have an attraction to women sexually. And unless angels have parts of their bodies like that, why would they have a sexual interest in women? I don't think they would. Men would. And therefore, I think it's more likely. Also, angels don't have human DNA because they don't have human bodies. Sometimes in the Bible, angels did materialize to meet with somebody, but we don't have any reason to believe that materializing in a human-like form meant that they are human all the way down to the genetic code, because the genetic code is the code that's got a history of ancestry and so forth. And if an angel is allowed to appear in a human form momentarily to talk to Abraham or to talk to Manoah and his wife or people like that, I can see God allowing them to take on a human form, but to have in every one of their cells DNA that has a history going back to Adam and Eve, I don't think that that's likely. I don't think that angels have human DNA, and therefore if they don't, then they can't reproduce with human beings, just like an animal cannot reproduce with human beings. They don't have the same human DNA. So I have my doubts about it being angels. Now, as far as their offspring being giants, many people read Genesis 6 that way, but if you read it carefully, it doesn't say that their offspring were giants or Nephilim. It says there were Nephilim. That's the word that's translated giants in many translations. It says there were Nephilim in the earth in those days. And also after that, when the sons of God went in and married the daughters of man, sons of God married the daughters of men, it says, and children were born to them. And so the Nephilim were in the earth before that and after that. So it doesn't indicate necessarily that the Nephilim were generated from those marriages. It just mentions that they lived at the same time on the earth as those marriages. And giants, there were giants. There still are, by the way. There still are giants. And not Jack and the Beanstalk type giants, but big people. Goliath was a giant. His father was a giant. He had four brothers who were giants. And David encountered them. Now, they were like 9 feet tall or something like that. They weren't the size of a skyscraper. They weren't the size of King Kong. But nonetheless, they were giants, and that's what were there in the earth, I believe, at that time. I think that's no doubt what is what's being implied there. I appreciate your call. Let's talk to Susan from San Mateo, California. Susan, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Actually, it's San Miguel, California, but I was calling about Daniel chapter 10, where it talks about they had to get the archangel Michael to fight to get Daniel's prayers answered for 21 days. Mm-hmm. I don't understand that, because God can knock Satan down in 1 second. I don't understand why it would take 21 days to get an answer to prayer.
What you're referring to, some people might not be familiar with, and that is that Daniel was praying and fasting for 21 days for some insight from God, and God sent it by an angel. But the angel took 21 days to get there. And when the angel arrived, he said to Daniel, the day you started praying, I was sent by God to bring you this message, but I was resisted by the principality of Persia, and it took me 21 days to get past him, and Michael had to be sent to, you know, aid me, and he's back there fighting with the principality of Persia now, and I'm going to give you this message, and I have to go back and help him. So this angel actually revealed there's some kind of a warfare going on in the heavenly realm that Daniel was not aware of, but the angels certainly had to deal with. Now, you said, couldn't God just knock the devil out of the air? Sure, he could. In fact, if he wanted to, he'd get rid of the devil right now, and we wouldn't have to deal with him. In fact, God could have gotten rid of the devil before Adam and Eve ever met the devil, if he wanted to. God is going to get rid of the devil. The Bible makes that very plain. Why he didn't do it earlier, before so much trouble was caused, is something that many people might be asking. And I think the reason is, if God could have gotten rid of the devil and didn't, it must be because in the way he set things up, there's a place for the devil. There's a role for the devil to play. And the role that the devil plays is as the tester or the tempter. Now, the devil also has apparently an organization of spirits that assist him. The principality of Persia, mentioned in Daniel chapter 10, almost all scholars agree, it's a reference to a demonic power in the heavenlies. Now, God, although he made the heavens and the earth and put man on it, and is willing to intervene for man whenever he is asked in faith to do so, that's what prayer is for, God has nonetheless turned the dealings of the world over to lesser beings, humans, and apparently demonic spirits. Now, it was probably man that turned it over to the demonic spirits. God gave it all to man. Man apparently submitted to the demonic spirits to the point where they gained, you know, advantage, and they in many respects influence the affairs of the world. That certainly is the impression that the Bible gives us. Now, God is going to finally get rid of them. He's going to get rid of the devil. He's going to get rid of the prince of Persia. He's going to get rid of every demonic power. And frankly, he's going to judge all wicked men too. But God has, his plan is to let this thing play out. There's something he's going for. There's something he's hoping will be accomplished. His kingdom, which was planted by Christ, is going to conquer the world, the Bible says. And it's going to be a great mountain to fill the whole earth. And so there's a plan here that has to do with the story. And many people don't understand the Bible's story. The story begins in Genesis and ends in Revelation. I think it ends even beyond that. But the truth is that God is letting this story play itself out in measure, but he is willing to intervene when he's asked. And that's what prayer is about. God has given us a battle to fight against the powers of darkness and a mission to accomplish in spreading his kingdom through the gospel. That's what God has put us here to do. And he's given us one resource that others don't have, and that is to ask him to empower them, to ask him to intervene, to ask him to push through his own agenda as we ask for it in Jesus' name, even against the powers that are greater than we are, which are demonic. But you're right, God is greater than they are, and the Bible affirms that. It's interesting. In fact, it affirms it in a place where it's actually saying that the demonic powers do have influence. It's in 1 John chapter 4. It says, don't believe all the spirits, because there's many false prophets. Many of them are not from God, and you have to beware of these false spirits. He says, but greater is he that is in you, meaning Christ, than he who is in the world, meaning the devil. So the Bible affirms that God and Christ are stronger than the devil, but also tells us we have to watch out for them, because they've got activities they're involved in, and presumably, if we don't watch out for them, they can get the advantage over us. Paul said that in 2 Corinthians 7, chapter 2, I think it's verse 7. He said, lest Satan should get an advantage over us, for we're not ignorant of his devices. In Ephesians 4, he said, do not let the sun go down on your wrath, neither give place to the devil. So it's possible, wrongfully, to give place to the devil, for the devil to get advantage over us. And this spiritual warfare in the heavenlies that Daniel is told about is something that we, I believe, are engaged in through our prayers, as Daniel was. There's this conflict in the heavens. We get a picture of it in Revelation 12, Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon and his angels. There's this heavenly thing, this battle, and Christians, I think, are called to participate in it through their prayers and through their obedience to Christ, and we're involved in a spiritual warfare, which defines the earth's history from Genesis 3 till the end of the world. And so, you know, when you say, well, why doesn't God just knock out the enemy? He can, but it's not time to get rid of him completely. This warfare is going to go on for a while because that's the means by which God's purposes are being accomplished. And why he chose that means, I'm not really sure we could say, but it is what the Bible reveals to be the facts of the case. All right. Let's talk to Simon from Kauai, Hawaii. Hi, Simon. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Yeah, I just have a question. I've actually noticed, or at least I think I've noticed, the American evangelicals today. It's almost like they vote people in and hope to run almost like this nation as a church rather than, they have this misplaced idea of the church and our nation and how the two kingdoms are kind of at odds. So it's almost like I have this frustrating thing where I'm trying to come to grasps with that and trying to understand what that looks like and how our role as Americans and how our role as people who vote is placed within that. Because I kind of look at it as in contradiction to 1 Corinthians chapter 5, where it tells us not to hold people outside of the church accountable.
Mm-hmm.
So if we were to go to the voting booth and vote, on everything that the Bible teaches, we'd have a nation where with all these,
a theocracy.
Yeah, exactly. And to me, I'm trying to understand where our place as Christians in that is.
Yeah.
Exactly. And,
okay.
And what that looks like, because to me, it's isn't that kind of Constantine to say, hey, if you look at this girl too long with lust, then we're going to throw you in jail,
Yeah.
Where's that line drawn at?
Okay, I'll be glad to address that. But before I do, I'm curious because we don't get many calls from Hawaii. Are you listening on the internet? Or are you listening? Can you hear the Honolulu station we're on? We're on KGU in Honolulu. I don't know.
No, yeah. Yeah, I just go on the internet on my phone and listen.
I see.
I don't ever listen live, so.
Yeah, I didn't think Honolulu station would reach Kauai, but I just was curious.
No, no.
Okay. Yeah, well, let me just say that I agree with you in some respects, and that is that there are some people who seem to want to turn America into a Christian nation in the sense of voting in Christian laws and things like that. And I don't think that that's the way that God planned things to go. But on the other hand, nations are supposed to be just. They are supposed to govern in justice. For example, the Bible makes it very clear that God appointed nations and rulers to punish evildoers, but not to punish good people. So there has to be some standard of good and bad. And therefore, for example, if a nation doesn't make laws against murder of innocent people, then they're not doing what God told the nation to do. Now, it's not our place to make them do it because God's kingdom is not of this world. But we live in a situation which none of the biblical writers did, and that is where we actually have some, at least, ability to have a say in the moral standards of society because we have votes. And some people believe that's a stewardship we have, that biblical people didn't have that. They didn't live in democratic republics where they could vote things in. They had to live under monarchs. But now we have, as it were, a responsibility. Now, responsibility not to make people into Christians by government. I don't believe in that. But I do think that if we love our neighbor as we love ourselves, and if we love our children, our grandchildren, and the grandchildren and children of our neighbors, we want them to live in a society, for example, where crime doesn't run rampant, where the laws are not corrupt. I don't want my children or your children or my grandchildren or your grandchildren to have to live in a society where innocent people don't have any protection from the government, because God ordained the government to protect the innocent and to punish criminals. So we might just say, well, if we don't have any input into government at all, that might be okay. But on the other hand, since we're the salt of the earth, it may be that God has given us input into the government as a unique, modern privilege that Christians have to help, you know, keep the worst abuses and injustices from becoming institutionalized, and therefore to vote for people who will not criminalize good behavior and who will not institutionalize evil behavior. If we have that choice, sometimes we don't. Sometimes all the candidates are corrupt, but if we had the choice, idealistically, I think there'd be something to be said for exercising our stewardship of saying, okay, I have something I can say and something I can do that may make the world a more tolerable place for my neighbor and his children, his grandchildren, and my own. And loving my neighbor as I love myself, it seems like that'd be a responsibility I would have. But on the other hand, to make laws that are specifically requiring people to do Christian things, I wouldn't be in favor of. I think that the church is wrongheaded in many countries where it used to, back in the Middle Ages and so forth, and much of this, of course, did begin with Constantine, obviously. I think the church was wrong to make people who are citizens be involved in the church and pay a tax to the church, and if they didn't believe what the church did, they'd be sent to the rack or to torture and made to comply. That's wrong. I mean, it's wrong for the government to make people be Christians. It's not wrong for the government to make people be just in their dealings with other people, because where there's injustice, then someone's being victimized. And so the government is there to maintain justice. So I think that Christians, if they have an ability to do so, just, you know, would do well to speak up for righteousness. And so, in some countries, they can't vote. But I think Christians should still speak up for what's right in those countries. And if they do have a vote, that might be a responsibility. Some people would say it is a responsibility that Christians have to vote moral things. Now, to tell people it's against the law for you to look at a woman to lust after her, that would be something that the government is not, it doesn't have the competence for. God never ordained the government to enforce proper thinking. The government is there to enforce proper behavior, that is to say, behavior that doesn't victimize other citizens. A man who's looking at a woman to lust after her, as long as he doesn't touch her, he's doing something immoral in the sight of God, and God will judge him for it, but he's not hurting her or her husband, you know, directly. So you can't make laws that govern people's thoughts. That's why I think the whole idea of hate crimes is a little bit ridiculous. If a crime is done against someone, it should be punished. It doesn't matter whether the person hated the person or hated the group of people that person was from. I mean, to try to, you know, have thought crimes and have the government enforcing a certain way of thinking is wrong. And I think it'd be as wrong for Christians to try to enforce Christian thinking on people. So Christianity obviously goes far beyond the basic morality that every nation should follow. But laws against murder, laws against, stealing, laws against bearing false witness, those would be things that every society should have. And in some societies, they don't. In some societies, they don't have those laws. And if Christians have been given the ability to vote, it may be reasonable to say God would like for them to stand up for what's righteous, although that's not the same thing as trying to turn the nation into a church or trying to make people into Christians. It's just trying to keep people from victimizing other people. And that's, you know, some people don't. Some people feel like the church shouldn't be involved in that. I'm not against it, but I, like yourself, I'm against the church trying to enforce its religion through law. I'm sorry we're out of time, or else I talk longer with you. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We're listener-supported. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate through the website, thenarrowpath.com. It's been great being with you. Let's talk again tomorrow. We'll continue our discussion. God bless you.